Welcome to Food for Thought. My name is Colleen Patrick-Goudreau. I'm an author and educator dedicated to empowering people to make informed food choices, to debunking myths about veganism, to being a voice for animals, and to giving people the tools and resources they need to live according to their own values of compassion and wellness. I'm the author of The Joy of Vegan Baking, The Vegan Table, Color Me Vegan, Vegan's Daily Companion, and my newest book, On Being Vegan, Reflections on a Compassionate Life, which is available as an ebook as well as paperback. And I think all of the cookbooks are also available as ebooks and paperback, of course. I'm also the creator and host of the 30-Day Vegan Challenge, which gives you everything you need to make the transition healthfully, joyfully, and deliciously. And as I've said, if you're already vegan, you'll get a lot out of it as well. You can also give it as a gift to friends and family. So check out 30dayveganchallenge.com. You can check out all of my work at compassionatecook.com. I'm very excited. I've been wanting to modify the homepage for a long time. You may not even notice any difference. I think when I first got it done, I told my husband and he looked at it and he went, great, looks great. And I'm like, do you see what I did differently? And he goes, no, but what did you do? So I can really see a difference, and maybe you will too, but I just think it'll be better. Even if you don't notice the specifics, I think you'll just know instinctively that it's better. You can also find me on Twitter and Facebook, and twitter.com/Patrick Goudreau and facebook.com/compassionatecooks. So check it out. And before I get started with today's episode, of course, I need to and want to thank my amazing platinum members. Our lovely Anonymous in Norway has become members of the Norwegian Vegan Society. So thank you so much, members of the Norwegian Vegan Society, for your support and for outing yourself as the supporter of the podcast. I highly encourage all of you to go to the website. Now I'm going to read it to you here, but you're not going to write it down because I know most of you are running or cooking or working out or something. So if you don't write it down, just go to my website, compassionatecook.com, and go to the special members page under about. It's vegan, S-A-M as in Sam, and then F as in Frank, U-N-N-E-T dot N-O as in Norway, and then /English, or if you speak Norwegian, just leave it there. Like I said, go to the special members page so you can go to the Norwegian Vegan Society's website, and thank you so much for your support. James Killen of Incentive Personal Training in Australia, I'm always so grateful to you, and your website, as you know, but to share it with everybody else, is www.personal-training.com.au, as in Australia. Grace Rodriguez, Tim Anderson, David Cabrera, and Alexander Gray. Alexander Gray Associates, which you can find out more about at alexandergray.com. That's Gray, G-R-A-Y. Peter and Eric of Peace Food Cafe in New York City. You know, it's my favorite restaurant in the world. Peacefoodcafe.com. I can't wait until you franchise out into Oakland, California. Chris Hanna of Propagandhi in Canada. I'm so grateful to you, Chris. Propagandhi.com. Propagandhi. I'm going to just say it right one of these days. Propagandhi. Gandhi, G-A-N-D-H-I.com. And Anonymous in Melbourne, Australia. You know who you are, and I thank you. And we have a new platinum member, Janie Mina. Is it Mina or Mena? M-E-N-A. Could be Mena. Janie Mena, who's actually a U.S. Army captain. Captain Janie Mena. I feel like I have to say captain because it wouldn't be right. And you can correct me, Janie, if you don't want to be known as captain, but I'm going to call you Captain Janie El Mina, and I'm so grateful for your support. You'll hear more about Janie and her support very soon. Thank you also to all of our gold members. We have a renewing gold member, Nat Dankin. Thank you so much, Nat. You're always so supportive. A new gold, annual gold members, Nina Tinnis, T-Y-N-Y-S, Tinnis or Tinnis. Kathleen, why are you giving all these names are so beautiful and intricate. Kathleen Zielkowski, pretty close. Justin and Jennifer Nemeth, and Anya Gretschka. And first, let me read an excerpt from Anya's beautiful letter. Dear Colleen, I've been wanting to write to you to express my gratitude for a while now. And although a little delayed, I want to thank you wholeheartedly for all that you do. Your podcasts in particular have been a significant part of my transformation to adopting a vegan lifestyle and continue to provide the inspiration and information that I seek on this journey. Your perspectives are captivating and eloquently presented. Thank you very much. I cannot thank you enough for your role in my awakening. I discovered your podcast at the beginning of this year and have been listening from the very beginning, working my way up the list. Even though I'm still catching up to current episodes, I accidentally came across your recent short episode asking for our support. I knew I would support your work at some point, but now seems like the perfect time. I want you to continue doing your part and we will do ours. Thank you so much, Anya. That's incredible. She goes on. My change to becoming a vegan was subtle and anticlimactic. In some ways, I didn't have a sudden aha moment, but it was life-changing nonetheless. I have been on and off vegetarian since high school, when I met a vegetarian girl who was skinny and I wanted to be like her. Also, having my older sister make pretend noises of how cows sound when they die helped the situation along. One day, I announced that I was vegetarian and will no longer eat the dishes that have meat in them. I instead ate double servings of mashed potatoes and mac and cheese. I had zero concept of nutrition. My mom said she would be vegetarian also to support me and started cooking a particular vegetable dish that I still, to this day, make almost each week. That's so sweet. For the first time, we consistently ate some vegetables beyond potatoes. 7 months later, my grandparents moved here from Russia. I couldn't resist my favorite dish called plov, made with rice and chicken. Plus, grandma said, it's crazy not to eat meat. One meal later, I was no longer vegetarian. I had several more uncommitted cycles of being vegetarian to improve my health. One time I ate a microwaved kotleta, which is ground meat in the form of a meatball, to break the cycle. Pretty uneventful. I just didn't think that it was particularly unhealthy and had no other strong reason not to eat animals. This time is different, though. I'd been eating one egg for breakfast for probably 7 years, and one morning I got sick and threw up. Likely, it wasn't the egg, but I decided the whole egg could have been a little chick concept was gross enough. I had come across so many people online saying how they love morning smoothies, and I figured I'd give it a try. But just out of curiosity, I wanted to cut out all animal products in my diet. So starting January 1st, 2013, I decided to be vegan for 1 week to form a new breakfast habit. I felt great, running seemed easier, and I ate more plants than ever before. I started making my own kombucha, reading about plant sources for various nutrients, and cooking often to ensure I'm always satisfied. I knew I was healthier, so I stuck with it. In the meantime, I educated myself with endless articles, nutrition books, inspirational stories, and podcasts, all dealing with a plant-based lifestyle. I am still vegan and see no other possible way. The self-education, sense of community, though it's virtual, and having moved to a new city, Seattle, away from home, have been invaluable aspects for me to transition and stick with it. The journey hasn't been flawless. My family wasn't very happy with my decision, of course, and still ask me if I'm not eating anything each time I come home to visit. Love that. In the beginning, I wanted to convince them that I'm not crazy or idealistic and once ate an egg, once had a bite of some fish. I'm still not sure what I was trying to prove to them. I realized that the more I stuck to exactly what I believed, the more they were willing to accommodate, seeing that I'm serious this time. Absolutely, Anya. I totally agree with that. It takes lots of effort, planning, and willpower to eat vegan when I travel, so much easier in my own space, but I simply can't unlearn what I know or desensitize myself. It's been 8 months now, and the process is just beginning to unfold. Although relatively short so far, I feel like this has been the most significant change in my life. I feel that I am being true to my values and I'm contributing to a better world. What more could we really ask of this life? Several aspects that I look forward to along my journey are getting involved with a vegan community in person, writing a relevant blog, and finding a form of activism that resonates with my own energy. Thank you for being on this journey with me, especially at such a fragile time in the beginning when I was likely to slip back to my old habits and worldviews. And thank you for inspiring and sharing so many positive ideas. I anxiously look forward to listening to all of your old podcasts and sincerely hope that there will be many more to come. With much gratitude, Anya. Thank you, Anya. That is so fantastic. You are very welcome. Absolutely made my day. It's so awesome. And then there's a beautiful letter from Justin and Jennifer Nemeth, who is a new Annual Gold members. It looks like the letter is in Jennifer's voice. Dear Colleen, my journey to becoming vegan all started when a physician told my husband 3 years ago that he had precursors to colon cancer at age 27. As you can imagine, we were shocked that this could be happening at such a young age. Coincidentally, the documentary Forks Over Knives came out around that time, and we decided to see a viewing of it. We first adjusted our diets by giving up red meat, then poultry, lastly fish and dairy somewhere in between. We both lost weight, dropped our cholesterol, and have more energy than we know what to do with at times. For us, going vegan was primarily for health reasons. That is, until we met Colleen while sailing the Caribbean on the Holistic Holiday at Sea cruise in March. That was March 2013. Colleen's powerful, elegantly presented talk deeply touched our hearts as we came to the conviction that not only did our lifestyle benefit our health, it saved our fellow animal friends from a tortured life. Even though it's depressing that our diet doesn't save every animal, I'm comforted thinking of the story of the young boy and the starfish. If you have not heard it, it's about a boy who starts throwing starfish back into the water that have been tossed upon the shore by the waves. When someone told him that his efforts were useless, since there were so many, he simply said, "Well, I'm making all the difference to this one and this one," as he returned them back to the water. Becoming vegan has completely revolutionized our lives. As a registered nurse, I'm currently in the process of getting out of our sick care system to start my own nutritional counseling practice. People are so often misguided to start more medications and have unnecessary surgeries when a change to a whole foods plant-based diet could heal their ailments. Please check out my website at reinventingnutrition.com. Will do. And everybody go check it out. I'd love to hear from any of your fellow listeners on how we can collaborate or how I can assist you in getting healthier. Thank you, Colleen, for being such an inspiration to so many and teaching us how to live compassionate lives. I'm excited to share your podcast and recipes with clients. With all respect, Jennifer and Justin Nemeth. That's so lovely. Thank you both, Jennifer and Justin. It is so special to hear that my talk was part of your journey. It really means so much to me. I might be going back on that cruise in 2015, so keep your ears perked. I'm just so grateful to be able to do this work. It is incredibly gratifying, and I am so grateful to all of you listeners, Anya and Nat and Kathleen and Nina and every one of you who makes it possible. Anyone who's ever contributed to this podcast or continues to contribute makes this podcast possible. Every contribution you make honestly makes it possible for me to do this podcast. So if you are willing and able to support the podcast, you can visit CompassionateCook.com and you can click the sign up button in the top right corner, or you can click on support under podcast in the menu. And also, this will be expiring soon, but for a limited time, I'm offering an ebook version of On Being Vegan, my newest book, to every new annual member. So whether you're a silver annual, gold annual, or platinum annual, you will receive an ebook, an e-version of On Being Vegan, in addition to what's listed on the website as the benefits for those different levels. And as I've said, because you've told me this, I know you support the podcast because you value it, but I really want to give you an extra gift. So there it is. And I have one more favor to ask of you. I don't know why. You can ask them yourself, but Veg News Magazine, for their Veggie Awards, still does not have a podcast category. They had it 1 year, and thanks to all of you, this podcast won for favorite podcast, but they haven't offered that category since. But in their 2013 Veggie Awards, I have been included in their favorite author category and their favorite website category. So if you would be so inclined, I ask that you would vote for me in those categories, and you can even do a write-in for the podcast, actually. So go to CompassionateCook.com and click on the graphic on the homepage that says Vote in the Veggie Awards. You'll see it right there on the homepage. Also, remember, you can subscribe to my YouTube channel, which you can, again, get to from my homepage. My homepage has all of the social networking links to Facebook and Pinterest and Instagram and YouTube and everything. So you can go there and subscribe. I'm slowly adding all of the podcast episodes, all of them, to my YouTube channel. So you can easily send the YouTube links to people to listen to the podcast. So it's just going to be another way to spread the word about the podcast. And while you're at it, please hop over to iTunes, leave a review, buy the app for a friend, follow me on these other social networking platforms, share links with your friends. And thank you very much. We are strong because of your support, and I'm very grateful. So I'm very much looking forward to sharing a very special person with you in this podcast episode named Michelle Montaigne. Michel de Montaigne. He lived from 1533 to 1592. Montaigne was born into a wealthy French family that came into nobility after his father fought in Italy for King Francis I of France. So they became nobility, and he spoke Latin. I mean, just his father wanted to make sure that he spoke Latin, but not just in school. He made everybody in the household speak Latin to Michel for the first 6 years of his life. So it was essentially his first language, Latin. Okay, even in the Renaissance at that time, Latin was not a household language. So it was pretty amazing. And these are the times I'm so jealous that I didn't have a classical education. So now you know. Now you know my secret burning desire to have had a classical education and to have spoken Latin. Yeah, that's what I want, okay? We all want different things in life. So he spoke Latin, and he read the classics at a very early age. So he was reading Virgil and Ovid and Homer at a very young age. He was educated in many different humanist schools in Europe, and he chose a mostly quiet life of reading and writing. He was prone to fits of melancholy, especially after his father and his best friend died. And making a long story very short, he set out to write his modestly titled but ambitiously written essays. And that's literally what we're going to talk about today, Essays by Montaigne. His aim in writing these essays, which became a proper genre because of Montaigne, essays as a proper genre hadn't existed before Montaigne. His intention was to work out his thoughts about the way the world worked and our place in it. The word essay means to try in French, to essay. To essay is to test, to taste, to try, to give it a go, as it were. And that's what Montaigne did. The topics he covers in his essays are so vast. His thoughts are incredibly humble, sometimes uncertain. Sometimes he talks about how he has a horrible memory and he can't remember things. He references poets and historical figures and philosophical thinkers. And yet the text is always accessible and very enjoyable. And frankly, for me, it makes me more inclined to read about other historical figures just to understand the references. It's quite comprehensive. He was so adept at weaving in and out of his own thoughts and the thoughts of these historical figures and then into anecdotes in order to illustrate the points he was trying to make. You'll notice a lot of that in the excerpts that I'm going to read. He was a master at that. So it just winds up feeling like you're talking to and listening to a really wise uncle tell you stories and kind of teaching you at the same time. But you don't know you're being taught because you're just so engrossed in the narration. He was just such a master at that. And they're written in first person, all of the essays. It's literally him kind of working out his own thoughts. They're very much his own thoughts and his own perceptions, but it never feels self-aggrandizing or egotistical. His range of knowledge, again, is just vast. His insights are really sensitive, very emotional at times, really profound. His perspective is sometimes very funny, sometimes irreverent, and he covers so many matters related to who we are and what makes us tick, but it's never didactic. So you can draw a lot from the essays about how to live, but he never tells you what to do and how to be. That's just not what his intention was with this. He reflects and he opines and he speculates and he ponders, but he doesn't dictate or mandate. That's not what he was trying to do. And I jokingly said to David, who recently finished reading them all, that I have enough opinions and thoughts and perspectives that I want to write my own version of essays like Montaigne. And he said, well, you do. You already do that on your podcast. He said, like Montaigne, you know, you reference historical figures and poets and writers and filmmakers and artists and philosophers, and you ponder what makes us as human beings tick. And I said, that's true. I do. And I thought, okay, well, that's who I'm aspiring to be, is Montaigne. And it's really true for anybody who writes blogs or who just writes in such a way that you're working out your ideas with stories and anecdotes, writing about yourself to create a mirror in which other people would recognize their own humanity. That was exactly what Montaigne essentially invented, was really creating this mirror that other people could look at and recognize their own humanity. It hadn't been done before him. And if that is true, that I am doing that in the vein of Montaigne, then I am incredibly honored to be able to. And I think that is exactly what we're doing here on the podcast. So that's exciting. So there's a link here with the podcast and Montaigne. Now, in reading the essays all at once, especially a good edition that reflects the changes and updates he made over the course of the 15 years that he wrote these essays. He began essays in about 1580, and the last edition was published in 1595, I mean, finalized in 1595, and it was edited by his daughter after his death, just a couple years after his death. So in reading them all at once, you really appreciate not only the fact that this was a work in progress and Montaigne went back and kind of changed things and modified things, but also that Montaigne really enjoyed the process of thinking, of piecing his thoughts together, of drawing from so many different disciplines to opine on a variety of topics. And although his ideas aren't necessarily all original, I mean, some are, but he wasn't really just echoing what had been said by great thinkers before him. He very much draws his own conclusions about everything he's writing about, whether he's writing about cannibalism or cruelty or drunkenness or the education of children. He had this ability to draw upon the classical thinkers, but make modern their ideas. It's one of the things that really makes him so unique. And in my opinion, and I think others would agree, it's what makes his essays so relevant still today. They have a contemporary and sometimes radical feel. As you'll hear in the excerpts I'm going to read today, it was he who shook some of the most fundamental aspects of Western thought, particularly the idea that we're superior to other animals. Obviously, that's just an opinion that some people hold, and that tends to be status quo, but he challenges this idea. And he was very much a writer and a very good writer, but he was really a philosopher in his own right. And I think he belongs in that school. I think he's often taught in literary classes, and he was indeed a very good writer. His writing is incredibly engaging, but he was a philosopher. And you'll see that, I think, when I share this with you. He was very influenced by the classical philosophers, particularly Socrates. He was greatly influenced by the Stoics. He was also influenced by his near contemporaries, particularly Erasmus and Thomas More. I say near contemporaries because they were closer than Socrates in terms of his time. And really, More and Erasmus, they essentially died kind of just after Montaigne was born. So it gives you an idea of who was in his age, essentially, who influenced him. So Thomas More, I'm sure you've heard of. I hope you've heard of Thomas More. He published Utopia in Latin in 1516. And he is undoubtedly one of the first writers since classical times to advocate mercy towards non-humans, albeit implicitly. Just to provide some context, in Utopia, More concocts an imaginary island that represents the perfect ideal society. And of course, if you put it together, Utopia means good place, right? From EU, which means good, and topos, which means place. And More, yes, coined this word utopia when he wrote this book. So in this utopia, there's no private ownership. It's very socialist. Everything everyone needs is kind of stored in this warehouse, and you request what you need when you need it and get what you need when you need it. There are no locks on the houses. Healthcare is free. Euthanasia is permitted. Priests are allowed to marry. Now, not everyone's going to agree that that's ideal, or even by our standards. There are certain things like premarital sex is punished by a lifetime of enforced celibacy, and slavery, mostly made up of criminals from other lands, is part of the society. So for what it's worth, whether More meant his work to be evidence that such a place is not possible, or whatever he was doing with it, there are ideas within it that are worth our attention. It's one of the reasons it still endures today, including how the utopians viewed animal slaughter and sacrifice. Let me read a little paragraph. The utopians kill no living beast in sacrifice, nor they think not that the merciful clemency of God hath delight in blood and slaughter, which hath given life to beasts to the intent they should live. They burn frankincense and other sweet savors, and light also a great number of wax candles and tapers, not supposing this gear to be anything available to the divine natures, as neither the prayers of men. But this unhurtful and harmless kind of worship pleaseth them, and by this sweet savors and lights and other such ceremonies, men feel themselves secretly lifted up and encouraged to devotion with more willing and fervent hearts. So the idea that we could please the gods without hurting anyone in the meantime is pleasing to the people who participate. And that's fantastic. I think that's a goal to which we can all aspire. Utopia was translated into English and printed in London 25 years after it was written and published in Latin. And so Moore was dead by the time it was published in English. And it was after the death of Henry VIII also, who, as you remember, had Moore executed for treason. Moore was opposed to Henry's separation from the Roman Catholic Church, and he refused to accept him as the head of the Church of England. That is to say, Moore's work influenced Montaigne, although Montaigne probably would have read it in Latin, to be honest. But they both explored similar ideas in their works. Montaigne, in turn, directly influenced many writers and thinkers throughout the world, some of whom we've talked about: Jean-Jacques Rousseau, William Hazlitt, Ralph Waldo Emerson. He influenced Friedrich Nietzsche, Isaac Asimov, and René Descartes, and possibly the later works of William Shakespeare. There's some evidence of some similar thoughts that Shakespeare couldn't really have gotten from anyone other than just kind of lifting Montaigne. And you can see some of those comparisons if you look online. Unfortunately, Montaigne greatly influenced Descartes in terms of the latter's application of learning through experience rather than merely through books. That was something he really took directly from Montaigne, to learn through experience rather than just through reading. But unfortunately, Descartes did not take to heart what Montaigne wrote about non-human animals and how we might want to humble ourselves a little bit to not lord over them, as you'll hear in what I'm going to read. Descartes, as you probably remember, he was the greatest single influence on animal vivisectors in his day and in centuries to follow. He believed animals did not feel pain or have the ability to reason and could therefore be cut into, that's what vivisection means, and essentially tortured without moral compunction. So we'll return to Descartes another time, but he is not who we want to talk about today. As a humanist, albeit a Christian one, but he was a humanist through and through, Montaigne refers mostly to the ancient philosophers and poets, as I said, Socrates, of course, Plutarch, and Pythagoras in his essays. And though the intellectual pool from which he draws is vast, it's embarrassing, really. Reading him, you just feel like, really, what have I done in the last 40 years? In the Penguin Classics edition from which I'll be reading, translated by M.A. Screech, there are over 1,250 pages of Montaigne's words, complete with footnotes. I recommend that you read the essays themselves. They're really enjoyable. There are many sections which concern us indirectly in the entire book, and which I plan on taking up perhaps in future episodes or maybe in subsequent books, such as the section called Of Cruelty. But what I want to read to you today are excerpts from the essay called An Apology for Raymond Sebund. It's the longest essay in the book, and it's the essay in which he spends a good chunk of time on animals. The chapter called Of Cruelty is short, and it's filled with thoughts worth reading, absolutely, particularly regarding the meaning of virtue. I really love what he has to say about virtue. It's the perfect precursor to the chapter that follows, which is An Apology for Raymond Sebund. It's not worth spending time reading the entire Of Cruelty chapter here. You'd think that that would be the one relevant for our episode, but it's not. Nonetheless, it is in the Of Cruelty chapter that Montaigne shares his disdain for, well, cruelty. Of course, he says, amongst all other vices, there is none I hate more than cruelty, both by nature and judgment, as the extremest of all vices. But he talks also about his disdain for hunting, though he reluctantly partakes in it for his guests. He wanted to be a good host, and that kind of meant a lot, especially if you were of the nobility at that time, probably even now. Similarly, he was expected to supply meat to his guests, so his cooks could make a proper table. But he would say that he couldn't even look at a chicken being killed. He couldn't look at a chicken whose neck would be wrung for this purpose. He clearly needed my podcast to hear about how you could be a gracious host and obviously not support cruelty. But he didn't have my podcast then. So here's a little excerpt from Of Cruelty. For my own part, I cannot, without grief, see so much as an innocent beast pursued and killed that has no defense, and from which we have received no offense at all. And that which frequently happens, that the stag we hunt, finding himself weak and out of breath and seeing no other remedy, surrenders himself to us who pursue him, imploring mercy by his tears. Pretty typical. I think most of us don't want to see any animal suffer. And I think those who do, they have desensitized themselves, as I've said before. So he was averse to it. He had an emotional reaction to it, I think, like most of us have. He also wrote, "Those natures that are sanguinary toward beasts, animals, discover a natural proneness to cruelty. After they had accustomed themselves at Rome to spectacles of the slaughter of animals, they proceeded to those of the slaughter of men, of gladiators. And that I may not be laughed at for the sympathy I have with them, with animals, theology itself enjoins us some favor in their behalf, and considering that one and the same master, God, the creator he's talking about, has lodged us together in this palace for his service, and that they, animals, as well as we, are of his family, it has reason to enjoin us some affection and regard to them, right? So great, perfect. I mean, a lot of philosophers, a lot of thinkers argued against cruelty to animals because it created cruelty in men toward other humans. And that was sometimes the reason they abhorred cruelty to animals, not for its own sake. And he's saying some of that, but he's also saying, like, no, we're kind of made of the same stuff. So why would our creator support us being cruel to those who are really our brethren? And so he says more of that in Of Cruelty. Recently, a woman named Sarah Bakewell, she's an author and part-time cataloger of rare books at the National Trust in London. She wrote a biography of Montaigne. It's called How to Live, or A Life of Montaigne in One Question and 20 Attempts at an Answer. And so it serves kind of as a self-help book, using Montaigne as the guide. And I think it's a brilliant idea. I haven't read it yet, but I have bought it, and I'm looking forward to reading it. I do highly recommend reading Montaigne's essays first and then reading hers, but I guess it's the next best thing if you don't read his, and I still want you to have kind of a firsthand experience of reading Montaigne, or just a firsthand experience understanding him, at least get her book. Here's what she had to say about Montaigne's essays, and then we're going to start. Thus, one cannot say after reading Montaigne that he leaves us in a moral void where it is impossible to know right from wrong, nor can one conclude that his rejection of reason-based systems make him a purely literary or descriptive writer. Although he is both relativistic and skeptical, he manages also to be every inch a moralist, a thinker, concerned with ways of living well and exercising good judgment. For him, one develops such judgment through living one's own life reflectively and being open to the lives of others. His desire to converse with the reader and to develop and try out essay, right, his own judgment, led him to write the essays. In doing so, he left us with excellent material for developing our own judgment too. And I think you'll enjoy some of what he has to say in essays. And here are some excerpts from the essay called An Apology to Raymond Sebund. I am not reading it in the original Latin. just to burst your bubble, I don't know what your expectations were. I am reading it in English. Let me start here. I hope you enjoy this. I'll kind of editorialize as necessary, but I think it's really exciting. There's some real gems in here. The natural original distemper of man is presumptuous. Man is the most blighted and frail of all creatures, and moreover, the most given to pride. This creature knows and sees that he is lodged down here among the mire and shite of the world, bound and nailed to the deadest, most stagnant part of the universe, in the lowest story of the building, the farthest from the vault of heaven. His characteristics place him in the third and lowest category of animate creatures, yet in thought, he sets himself above the circle of the moon, bringing the very heavens under his feet. The vanity of this same thought makes him equal himself to God, attribute to himself God's mode of being, pick himself out and set himself apart from the mass of other creatures, and, although they are his fellows and his brothers, carve out for them such helpings of force or faculties as he thinks fit. How can he, from the power of his own understanding, know the hidden inward motivations of animate creatures? What comparison between us and them leads him to conclude that they have the attributes of senseless brutes? When I play with my cat, how do I know that she is not passing time with me rather than I with her? In his description of the golden age under Saturn, Plato counted among one of the principal advantages which man then had, his ability to communicate with the beasts. Inquiring and learning from them, man knew what they were really like and how they differed from each other. By this means, man used to acquire a full understanding and discretion, leading his life far more happily than we ever can now. After that, do we need a better proof of the impudence of man towards beast? Well, that great author then opined that nature mainly gave the beast their bodily forms to enable the men in his time to foretell the future. Why should it be a defect in the beasts, not in us, which stops all communication between us? We can only guess whose fault it is that we cannot understand each other, for we do not understand them any more than they understand us. They may reckon us to be brute beasts for the same reason that we reckon them to be so. It is no great miracle if we cannot understand them. We cannot understand Basque or troglodytes. Some have boasted, though, that they could understand the beasts: Apollonius of Thyana, Melampus, Tiresias, Thales, and others. And since there are nations, so the cosmographers tell us, who acknowledge a dog as their king, they must interpret its bark and its movements as having some definite meaning. We ought to note the parity there is between us. We have some modest understanding of what they mean. They have some of us in about equal measure. They fawn on us, threaten us, and entreat us as we do them. Meanwhile, we discover that they manifestly have converse between themselves, both whole and entire. They understand each other, not only within one species, but across different species. A horse knows there to be anger in a given bark of a dog, but that horse does not take fright when the same dog makes some other meaningful cry. Even in beasts who cannot utter meaningful sounds, we can readily conclude that there is some other means of communication between them from the way they work purposefully together. Their very movements serve as arguments and ideas. And why not? Our deaf mutes have discussions and arguments, telling each other stories by means of signs. I have seen some who are so nimble and so practiced at this that they truly lack nothing necessary for making themselves perfectly understood. After all, lovers quarrel, make it up again, beg favors, give thanks, arrange secret meetings, and say everything with their eyes. And then he goes on, so he says that we obviously can communicate with our eyes really well, and he goes on to say that we communicate with our hands in all sorts of ways. We communicate with our heads, we communicate with our eyebrows and our shoulders. So his point is that we in all ways communicate without actually speaking. And so he says this suggests, given the variety and different usage among spoken languages, that it is rather sign language that should be judged the property of man. So that's an interesting conclusion he draws from that. And I think it's interesting. And of course, we know that animals have all other ways of communicating with each other rather than just their voice. But I really appreciate what he's saying. He's saying that it's not language that distinguishes us from other animals. Perhaps it's sign language. Perhaps it's specifically what we can do with our hands and heads and eyebrows. But we know that there are facial expressions and body signals that other animals give to one another as well. After all, what aspects of our human competence cannot be found in the activities of animals? Is there any form of body politic more ordered, more varied in its allocation of tasks and duties, or maintained with greater constancy than that of bees? Can we conceive that an allocation of tasks and activities so striking for its orderliness should be conducted without reasoned discourse or foresight? Take the swallows. When spring returns, we can see them ferreting through all the corners of our houses. From 1,000 places, they select one, finding it the most suitable place to make their nest. Is that done without judgment or discernment? And then, when they are making their nests so beautifully and so wondrously woven together, can birds use a square rather than a circle, an obtuse angle rather than a right angle, without knowing their properties or their effects? Do they bring water and then clay without realizing that hardness can be softened by dampening? They cover the floors of their palaces with moss or down. Do they do so without foreseeing that the tender limbs of their little ones will lie more softly there and be more comfortable? Do they protect themselves from the stormy winds and plant their dwellings to the eastward without recognizing the varying qualities of those winds and considering that one is more healthy for them than another? Why does the spider make her web denser in one place and slacker in another, using this knot here and that knot there, if she cannot reflect, think, or reach conclusions? We are perfectly able to realize how superior they are to us in most of their works and how weak our artistic skills are when it comes to imitating them. Our works are coarser, and yet we are aware of the faculties we use to construct them. Our souls use all their powers when doing so. Why do we not consider that the same applies to animals? Why do we attribute to some sort of slavish natural inclination works that surpass all that we can do by nature or by art? In this, we thoughtlessly give them a very great superiority over us. We make nature take them by the hand and guide them with a mother's gentle care in all the actions and advantages of their lives. We, on the other hand, are abandoned by nature to chance and to fortune, obliged to seek by art all things necessary for our conservation. Meanwhile, nature refuses us the very means which would enable us to reach, by education or intelligent application, the level reached by the natural industry of other creatures. In this way, we make their brutish stupor have every advantage over our divine intelligence. In truth, on this account, we would be right to treat nature as a very unjust stepmother, but it is not so. We do not live under so misshapen or so lawless a constitution. Nature clasps all her creatures in a universal embrace. There is not one of them which she has not plainly furnished with all means necessary to the conservation of its being. And then he goes on to describe some examples of that. And then I'm going to continue with one that he says here, talking about eating. As for eating, it is natural to us and to them. It does not have to be learned. Does anyone doubt that a child, once able to feed himself, would know how to go in search of food? And earth, with no farming and with none of our arts, produces quite enough for his needs and offers it to him, perhaps not at all seasons, but neither does she do that for the beasts. Witness the stores we can see ants or others provide for the barren season of the year. Those peoples we have recently discovered, so abundantly furnished with food and natural drinks, needing no care or toil, have taught us that there is other food besides bread, and that Mother Nature can provide us plenteously without plowing, with all we need, indeed, as is likely, more straightforwardly and more richly than she does nowadays when we have brought in our artificial skills. The lawless flood of our greed outstrips everything we invent to try and slake it. So the point being that even without agriculture, nature has provided us everything we need to be able to eat. And I mean, this comes up a lot, right? When we talk about eating seasonally and we talk about eating, you know, as close to the seasons as possible. And people say, well, what about the people in the mountains of Tibet? Or what about the people who are living places where it gets cold in the wintertime? All animals learned to store food for the winter, and we can do the same thing. I mean, that's what we can do with preserving things or with canning things and et cetera. So it's something all animals do, and I think it's a worthy parallel. So he goes on to talk about some other examples of how nature gives us all of these things equally. It's all to be able to survive. And he uses language as another example, he says at one point. It is simply not believable that nature has refused to us men a faculty granted to most other animals. We can see they have means of complaining and rejoicing and calling on each other for help or inviting each other to love. They do so by meaningful utterances. If that is not talking, what is it? How could they fail to talk amongst themselves since they talk to us and we to them? How many ways we have of speaking to our dogs and of they replying to us. We use different languages again and make different cries to call birds, pigs, bulls, and horses. We change idiom according to each species. I love that. It's really true, isn't it? I have a different voice for each kind of animal. And one thing I heard a long time ago, this is a complete aside, I thought was really interesting, is that cats, in terms of communicating with one another and communicating with their people, cats do not meow to one another. And if any of you have cats, you'll know what I mean. Cats don't meow. The way they meow to us, and you know, I have all these different variations of my cats meowing to me, they don't do that with each other. They have different vocalizations and mostly body language that they use to communicate with each other, but they meow only to humans. I think that's really cool. Montaigne saw it. Montaigne already knew it. And so he goes on and says more about language. And then he says, I've gone into all of this to emphasize similarities with things human, so bringing man into conformity with the majority of creatures. We are neither above them nor below them. Everything under the sky, said the wise man, runs according to like laws and fortune. All things are enchained in the fetters of their destiny. Some difference there is. There are orders and degrees, but always beneath the countenance of nature, who is one and the same. So we may be different in degree, but not in kind. And that's what Montaigne is saying here. Said it first. Mm-hmm. Okay, so what else does he say here? To get back to the subject, there is, I say, no rational likelihood that beasts are forced to do by natural inclinations the selfsame things which we do by choice and ingenuity. From similar effects, we should conclude that there are similar faculties. Consequently, we should admit that animals employ the same method and the same reasoning as ourselves when we do anything. I love these examples he gives. Why should we think that they have inner natural instincts different from anything we experience in ourselves? Our empty arrogance makes us prefer to owe our own adequacies to ourselves rather than to the bounty of nature. We prefer to lavish the natural goods on other animals, giving them up so as to flatter and honor ourselves with acquired properties. This is the idea that we always say that, you know, animals just do everything by instinct and we do it by learning. And that's one of the ways we totally keep them down and make us look much better. We do that, it seems to me, says Montaigne, out of some simple-minded humor. Personally, I value graces which are mine since I was born with them more than those which I have had to beg and borrow as an apprentice. It is not within our power to acquire a higher recommendation than to be favored by God and nature. So he's saying, let's flip it around. You know, we make it seem like, well, they do everything by instinct is a negative thing. And he's saying, that's actually better. So here's some examples. And here's an example of how he goes right into anecdote from his speculation. Consider the fox which Thracians employ when they want to cross the ice of a frozen river. With this end in view, they let it loose. Were we to see it stopping at the river's edge, bringing its ear close to the ice to judge from the noise how near to the surface the current is running, darting forward or pulling back according to its estimate of the thickness or thinness of the ice, would it not be right to conclude that the same reasoning passes through its head as would pass through ours, and that it rationates, he uses this word rationates, rationalize, I think is what he's saying, and draws consequences by its natural intelligence like this. And he quotes, this is what the fox would be thinking. That which makes a noise is moving. That which moves is not frozen. That which is not frozen is liquid. That which is liquid bends under weight, attributing all that exclusivity to its keen sense of hearing without any reasoning or drawing of consequences on the part of the fox is unthinkable. The same judgment should apply to all the ingenious ruses by which beasts protect themselves from our schemes against them. So like to think that it's just instinct is ridiculous, he's saying. Should we pride ourselves on our ability to capture them and make them work for us? But that is no more than the advantage we have over each other. Our slaves are in the same condition. And he kind of gives some examples of slaves. So, you know, we do the same thing. We can enslave animals, we can enslave other human beings, and we do. So going on, oh, I love this one too. It's an argument for humility. Why do we say, in the case of man, that distinguishing plants, which are useful for life and for medicines, from those which are not, recognizing, say, the virtues of rhubarb, is a sign that he has scientific knowledge based on skill and reason? Yet the goats of Candia can be seen picking out dittany, I guess it's a kind of herb, from a million other plants when they are wounded by spears. If a tortoise swallows a viper, it at once goes in search of origanum as a purge. The dragon wipes its eyes clear and bright with fennel. Storks give themselves salt water enemas. Elephants can remove darts and javelins thrown in battle from their own bodies, from those of their fellows, and even from those of their masters. Witness the elephant of that King Porus who was killed by Alexander. They do so with more skill than we ever could while causing so little pain. Why do we not call it knowledge and discretion in their case? To lower them in esteem, we allege that nature, instinct, alone is their schoolmaster. But that is not to deprive them of knowledge or wisdom. This is his observation. It is to attribute them to them more surely than to ourselves, out of respect for so certain a teacher. So the idea is that we want to create as much uniformity amongst the non-human animals and as much away from us, right? So they're all like X and not like us, right? If you think about how vast the animal kingdom is, it's pretty bold that we just say, oh yeah, all of them are inferior to us. Every single one of them is inferior to us. So the more we can kind of link them all together into one body so that we can come out looking a lot more superior is why he says we do that. He goes on to some more. He gives another example of a dog who uses discretion. He gives another example. Let me read this. Oh, I like this one. Yet beasts like us are not incapable of instruction. So, you know, that's all to say that that doesn't mean that they can't learn either. So yes, they use instinct and they use discretion and they use intelligence and reasoning, as do we. But he also says they're also incapable of instruction. Blackbirds, ravens, magpies, and parrots can be taught to speak. We recognize in them a capacity for making their voice and their breath subtle and pliant enough for us to mold and restrict them to a definite number of letters and syllables. That capacity witnesses to an inward power of reasoning, which makes them teachable and willing to learn. We have all had our fill, I expect, of the sort of monkey tricks which minstrels teach their dogs to do. Those dances in which they never miss a note they hear, or those varied jumps and movements which they perform on command. But I am much more moved to wonder by the action of the guide dogs used by the blind in town and country, common enough as they are. I have watched those dogs stop at certain doors where people regularly give alms, and seen how even when there is room enough to squeeze through themselves, they still avoid encounters with carts and coaches. I have seen one following the town trench, but abandoning a level, even path for a worse one, in order to keep its master away from the ditch. How was that dog brought to realize that it was its duty to neglect its own interests and to serve its master? How does it know that a path might be wide enough for itself, but not wide enough for a blind man? Could all that be grasped without thought and reasoning? And he gives another example of that. Just get over it that he uses the word it. I know that we talk about using words that are more compassionate, but, you know, Montaigne was still of his time, and I think he's doing a pretty darn good job of challenging a lot of ideas of his time. And then he gives some examples not only of being able to learn, of animals, non-human animals, not only being able to learn, but being able to teach. You need still greater powers of reason to teach others than to be taught yourself. Democritus thought and proved that we had been taught most of our arts by animals. The spider taught us to weave and to sew, and the swallow to build. The swan and the nightingale taught us music, and many other animals taught us by imitation and the practice of medicine. Moreover, Aristotle maintains that nightingales teach their young to sing, spending time and trouble doing so. That explains why the song of nightingales brought up in cages with no freedom to be schooled by their parents loses much of its charm. From that we may conclude that any improvement is due to learning and study. Even nightingales born free do not all sing one and the same song. Each one sings according to its capacity to learn. They make jealous classmates, squabbling and vying with each other so heartily that the vanquished sometimes drops down dead, not from lack of song, but lack of breath. The youngest birds ruminate thoughtfully and then begin to imitate snatches of song. The pupils listen to the lessons of their tutors and then give an account of themselves, taking it in turns to stop their singing. You can hear their faults being corrected. Some of the criticisms of their tutors are perceptible, even to us. I love that. Love that. Okay, so he says a couple other examples. It's really sweet. He talks about elephants and he says, but so many of their actions bring elephants close to human capacities that if I wanted to relate in detail everything that experience has shown us about them, I would easily win one of my regular arguments that there is a greater difference between one man and another than between some men and some beasts. I love that. Just what I was saying. Just love it. Okay. And then you know, he talks about the fact that we tend to other, as we've talked about in this podcast. We think anything that we don't know about is strange or weird or different or inferior, right? So we do that just in general, and we do it to non-human animals. Everything which seems strange, we condemn, as well as everything we do not understand. That applies to our judgments on animals. Many of their characteristics are related to ours. That enables us to draw conjectures from comparisons. But they also have qualities peculiar to themselves. What can we know about that? Horses, dogs, cattle, sheep, birds, and most other animals living among men recognize our voices and are prepared to obey them. Why, Crassus even had a lamprey, which came to him when he called it. And there are eels in the fountain of Arethusa, which do the same. I have seen stews in plenty where the fish, on hearing a particular cry from those who tend them, all rush to be fed. And he goes on to some other examples. We can partly do so in the case of the activity noticed by Cleanthes, the philosopher, because it resembles our own. So here he said, Cleanthes, he saw, he said, ants leave their own anthill for another one, bearing the body of a dead ant. Several others came out to meet them, as if to parley. They remained together for some time. Then the second group of ants went back to consult. It was thought their fellow citizens. They made two or three such journeys because of hard bargaining. In the end, the newcomers brought a worm out from their heap, apparently as a ransom for the dead ant. The first lot loaded it on their shoulders and carried it back, leaving the body of the dead ant with the others. And then he says, that is the interpretation given by Cleanthes. It witnesses to the fact that voiceless creatures are not deprived of mutual contact and communication. If we cannot share in it, that is because of a defect in us. We would be very stupid indeed to have any meddlesome opinions on the matter. Animals do many actions which surpass our understanding. Far from being able to imitate them, we cannot even conceive them in our thoughts. And then he talks about justice, how animals use justice. He talks about household management. Of course, he talks about bees again. As for household management, beasts surpass us in the foresight necessary to gather and store for the future, as we said before, and also possess many of the kinds of knowledge required to do so. When ants notice their grain or seeds going moldy and smelling badly, they stop them from spoiling or going rotten by spreading them on the ground outside their storehouses, airing, drying, and freshening them up. But the measures and precautions they take to gnaw out their grains of corn surpass any imaginable human foresight. Corn does not always stay dry and wholesome, but gets soft, flabby, and milky as a step towards germinating and sprouting anew. To stop it turning to seed corn and losing its nature and properties as grain in store for future use, ants gnaw off the end, which does the sprouting. Pretty fancy pants, if you ask me. And then he talks about war. He talks about gratitude and how we all share gratitude. He gives a pretty long story. I'm not going to read that story, but it's a good story. You can read it yourself, about a lion who helped a man in a cave. And then he talks about some peoples hold their wives in common, while in others each man has a wife of his own. Can we not see the same among the beasts? And again, you know, the word beast was used to talk about animals. It wasn't a derogatory term then. It is now. We don't, you know, when we say someone's a beast, it's derogatory, but it wasn't then. It was a word that was used to talk about animals. Do they not have marriages better kept than our own? As touching the confederations and alliances which animals make to league themselves together for mutual succor, oxen, pigs, and other animals can be seen rushing in to help when one of their number is being attacked and rallying round in its defense. If a scarfish swallows a fisherman's hook, its fellows swarm around and bite through the line. If one of them happens to get caught in a wicker trap, the others dangle their tails down into it from outside while it holds on grimly with its teeth. In this way, they drag it right out. When a barbel fish is hooked, the others stiffen the spine which projects from their backs. It is notched like a saw. They rub it against the line and saw through it. I don't know if that's true, but it's pretty amazing. As for the special duties we render to each other in the service of life, there are several similar examples amongst the animals. The whale, it is said, never travels without a tiny fish like a sea gudgeon swimming ahead of it. For this reason, it is called a guide fish. The whale follows it everywhere, allowing itself to be directed and steered as easily as a rudder turns a boat. Everything else, beast or ship, which falls into the swirling chaos of that creature's mouth is straightway lost and swallowed up. Yet that little fish can retire there and sleep in its mouth in complete safety. While it is asleep, the whale never budges, but as soon as it swims out, the whale constantly follows it. If it should chance to lose its guide fish, it flounders about all over the place, often dashing itself to pieces against the rocks like a rudderless ship. Plutarch testifies to having seen this happen on the island of Anticyra. Interestingly, I feel like I'm reading like Jonathan Balcombe's book, because this is the kind of thing we do now, right? These are the kind of anecdotes we tell to persuade people that animals are intricate and have sensitive and interesting lives. And if we're not looking, we wouldn't even know that it's happening. And then he talks about beauty, and I really like what he says about beauty. He says, "Nature has no more given man privileges in beauty than in any other of her common laws. If we judge ourselves fairly, we will find some animals less favored than we are, others more numerous, which are more so. We are surpassed in beauty by many of the beasts, especially among our fellow citizens, the denizens of dry land. As for the creatures of the sea, we can leave their beauty of form aside, since it has no point of comparison with ours. We are thoroughly beaten by them in color, brightness, sheen, and the general disposition of our members. Beaten by the birds of the air, too, in all qualities." I love that fish and birds take precedence here. I love that he talks about fish as much as he does. He talks about fish a lot, which we need more of. And then there is that privilege the poets stress, the fact that we hold ourselves erect, gazing up to heaven from whence we came. The other animals look downwards to the ground. God gave man a face held high and ordered him to look toward heaven and raise his eyes toward the sun, moon, and stars. That privilege is well and truly poetic, he says. He's quoting, by the way, what the poets would say. That was why I write it in a sarcastic voice. And he says, that privilege is well and truly poetic. Some quite small animals gaze up to heaven all the time. Camels and ostriches seem to me to have necks straighter than ours and more erect. And which are these animals, which are supposed to not have faces in front and on top, not to look straight ahead as we do not, in their normal posture, to see as much of heaven and earth as we do? What characteristics of man's body, as described by Plato and Cicero, do not equally apply to 1,000 other animals? The animals most like us are the worst. Well, this is actually, he doesn't say a very nice thing about baboons here, which they are hard to love, I have to admit. The animals most like us are the worst and the ugliest of the bunch. The one with an outward appearance and face closest to ours is the baboon. The one with inwards and vital organs closest to ours is the pig, which is true. When I think of the human animal stark naked with all its blemishes, natural weaknesses, and flaws, I find that we have more cause to cover ourselves up than any other animal. That even applies to the female sex, which seems to have greater share of beauty. We could be excused for having borrowed from those which nature has favored more than us, decking ourselves in their beauty, hiding ourselves in their coats, wool, feathers, hide, or silk, so we cover ourselves with their beauty. We may note that we are the only animals whose physical defects are offensive to our other fellows. We are also the only ones to hide from others of our species when answering the calls of nature. That is true. Guilty as charged. Well, that is a frank and artless admission, and I accept it. At least philosophers have admitted that all those qualities that they make such a fuss about are fantastic and vain. He's just kind of concluding that in the end, still humans would rather be human than be turned into an animal. And he says, sure, great, fine. But even if the beasts had all the virtue, knowledge, wisdom, and contentment of the Stoic, they would still be beasts. This is what he's kind of quoting other people to say. In no way to be compared to any man, however wretched, wicked, or daft. In fine, nothing is worth anything if it does not look like us, right? This is what we tend to say. Even God has to become like us, right? Because we do kind of make God in our own image. He says he made us in his own image, but we really personify God. Even God has to become like us to be appreciated. I shall go into that later. And he does. It is clear from this that we do not place ourselves above other animals and reject their condition and companionship by right reason, but out of stubbornness and insane arrogance. That's what he said. I didn't say it. To get back to the subject, we have been allotted inconstancy, hesitation, doubt, pain, superstition, worries about what will happen even after we are dead, ambition, greed, jealousy, envy, unruly, insane, and untamable appetites, war, lies, disloyalty, backbiting, and curiosity. We take pride in our fair, discursive reason and our capacity to judge and to know, but we have bought them at a price which is strangely excessive if it includes those passions without number which prey upon us. Unless, that is, we choose, like Socrates, to pride ourselves on the one noteworthy prerogative we do have over the beasts. Nature lays down limits and seasons to their lusts, but gives us a full rein anytime, any place. So he says, one thing we have over them is that we, let's say, consummate our affections for one another any time of the year rather than just in certain seasons. And so he says, a little bit more, but I will let this subject drop. It would draw me further on than I want to go. I will merely add this. Only humility and submissiveness can produce a good man. There is a plague on man, his opinion that he knows something. And so the entire essay, his entire point is to, you know, humble us. And I've said this before, that we need to not only, you know, kind of humble ourselves a little bit, but also raise animals up. Right now, what we have done was we've created a system whereby anything that is not human, anything that is non-human animal is inferior. And I don't think it's working. And Montaigne knew that back in the 16th century. And I really encourage you to read his essays for yourself, particularly those chapters, the Apology to Raymond Sebund of Cruelty. There's another chapter he talks about habit, which is really relevant for our discussion around consumption of animals, and many, many, many more that I think you'll find fascinating. So I hope that was interesting to you. And I look forward to sharing with you many other thoughts from thinkers from across the ages who agree with all of us that compassion is the highest ethic and that we are certainly no better than anyone else with whom we share this planet. For the animals, both human and non-human, this is Colleen Patrick-Goudreau. Thanks for listening.